Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you're a regular listener, you know the purpose of this show. We want to remind you that freedom isn't free. We want to remind you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, there's probably a hero next door or around the block or somewhere in your hometown, someone who put his or her life on the line for the freedom that we enjoy. We want to honor our World War II veterans. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, and maybe along the way, the rest of us are inspired. And I think that'll be the case today. We're joined by Ted Robinson of Sacramento, California. He's the author of a book called Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. Now, that title alone, I'm sure, is enough to intrigue you. And in the days ahead, you're going to be hearing a lot about President John F. Kennedy, because November 22nd, this coming Monday, is the anniversary of his death in Dallas in 1963. And this time of year, I'm sure Ted Robinson reflects back to the skinny, half-naked man that he helped rescue in the Pacific during World War II. So let's bring Ted in now. Ted, I understand you're only 91 years old, huh?
That's right.
And you just got done with a tennis match?
That's right. I played for Duke University. I played for Flushing High School, which the U.S. Open has made in Flushing, which in the 20s was the number one high school team in the United States. I was number two on that team. I was only number seven on Duke, because Duke has some great tennis teams. In fact, their girls won the NCAA championship this year.
And who did you play today?
I played a gal who once played Althea Gibson, the great African-American tennis player in Los Angeles in 1962 for the Women's World Champion. She lives here in Sacramento. She was number one on the German Federation Cup team at one time.
And she's only 67.
Yeah, she's getting old.
How long are you going to keep playing tennis?
Well, as long as I can. I gave up skiing, black diamond, high-speed skiing, just 3 years ago, and that's only because my big buddy ski partner, who's 11 years younger than I, had to give it up. So I lost my ski partner, and otherwise, I'd still be doing that. I'm very lucky in my health and very lucky in World War II, as you will hear.
Well, and you wouldn't be talking to me if you weren't. And if not for something you were involved in, we never would have had a President John F. Kennedy. We're going to get that entire story from you. You talk about being from Flushing, New York, and being a tennis player in Flushing Meadows. And I'm just flashing back to a story I did on television long ago here in Fresno at the sewage treatment facility. They have a big green area that they call Flushing Meadows. And every once in a while, they'll go out and hit some tennis rackets around. You get the joke, of course, Flushing Meadows at the sewage treatment plant. But a little different than what you grew up with.
Yeah, well, you know, Flushing actually was the ash dump for New York City. Back when everybody used coal in the winter for heat, at Flushing Meadows, they dumped all the New York City ashes there and actually filled up a huge hole. And so the stadium where the U.S. Open is played is on top of all that, those ash remains in New York City that was dumped there. So New York, Flushing is kind of a dump.
But it gave us you.
Nobody from Flushing's living, but that's really a very nice place. It's all Korean now anyway, so they wouldn't understand. They all speak Korean in Flushing now, and they're very nice people.
You grew up in Flushing, New York, and how did you become a Navy man?
The reason that the title of the book is The Pauper, my dad died very suddenly, right at the end of World War II in that flu epidemic. He died in January of 1920, and I was 8 months old when he died, and we had a Packard car, a chauffeur, a limousine. He was vice president of W.R. Grayson Company at age 32. He was the Wall Street Journal had a big article that he was just a financial genius. But he hadn't expected to die at 32. And suddenly, gone was the Packard car, the governess, and the will paid off the mortgage on the house. and left her some stocks, which of course became worthless during the Depression in 1929-30. Mm-hmm. And my we lived. I was brought up by my grandfather, my mother's father, who was stone deaf, lame, poor janitor, just in total poverty. We had a nice house, but my mother had to go door to door selling greeting cards. And at 10 years old, I was trying to sell pork sausage meat door to door in a Jewish neighborhood.
Good luck with that.
That's true. Yeah. So, what do you want to know next?
Well, and you in your write-up on your book, you describe yourself as being the poorest kid at Duke. Did you go there specifically to play tennis?
No, there were no tennis scholarships then. There were no scholarships of any type. But I came number two in Flushing High academically, and I could have gone to Harvard or any of those great schools. But Duke was cheap. In those days, the Duke Cathedral had just been finished a year before I went to Duke in 1936, and it was only $795 a year. It is now $46,500. But when I went there for two reasons. One, it was far cheaper than the other really fine schools, and Duke was a fine school. But stop and think about it. Duke was the number one co-educational school on the East Coast. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, male only. Smith, Wellesley, girls only. I like girls. I thought it was very abnormal to go to a school with just men or just girls. And so that's why we chose Duke. It was cheap, and they had some very beautiful Southern gals.
Uh-huh. Now I understand your thinking.
Yeah.
And you had already graduated from Duke by the time Pearl Harbor rolled around. Do you remember where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Yes, I had a very fine job with the Chemical Bank in New York, which is now part of Chase Manhattan. I was an executive trainee because every bank in America has a corresponding bank in New York City because Wall Street and all is the financial capital of the world. And Chemical was the head of the southeast part of the country. Duke was in Durham, North Carolina, so they wanted Duke graduates because they served all that area, Florida, Georgia, Alabama. And I was both gone to Duke, and I lived in New York. So they had brought me in as a executive trainee, and I had a wonderful job. But I had already gone down in May of 1941, before Pearl Harbor, and signed up for the U.S. Navy because I could see we were going to get into this war. And also, if you read my book, there's a wonderful story in there about some neighbors of ours, the Scott family, who owned lock, stock, and barrel what was then the first Walmart in the world. It was the Army-Navy stores. And old Captain Scott was a graduate of Annapolis, and during World War One, he was the chief of staff for supply of the United States Navy. So do you have any idea how he might have got a hold of the Navy stuff for that? But anyway, they eventually saw our tragic condition, what had happened when my dad died. My dad had been friend to Captain Scott's. My dad had a bigger job than Captain Scott. So we stayed in the house because it was paid off, and my mother kept secret how terrible we were doing until a time in the book that you have to read that they discovered we were just about starving. Mm. And so they began to feed me, my brother and I, because my mother, well, I get too emotional about how bad off we were. And they kind of adopted my brother and I, and there was no doubt that I would go in the U.S. Navy because it was a Navy family that literally saved our family. Wonderful, wonderful people.
Well, that is good enough motivation in my book. And so yes. You had already enlisted in the Navy.
Yes.
But where were you? What do you remember? How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked
Pearl Harbor? Well, I was out playing touch football in a lot, some neighbors hollered over that we better cut our game off and go down and get in our uniforms because the Japanese had just attacked us at Pearl Harbor. We were out playing touch football, and so I ran home, and I called the Navy right away and said, do you want me? And they said, no, you're due to go in the class of, and it starts January 22nd at midshipman school, and you just come at that time. So I quit my job with a chemical bank, and I went skiing in Lake Placid. Even though we were poor, I knew it was my last chance to ski. And I went up skiing, and I've been a great skier ever since. I love skiing. In fact, I moved to California because here you can ski at 12,000 feet at Heavenly Valley, although that's a pretty tame resort, I think. Next question.
Pretty tame for a 91-year-old, huh?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm a pretty good skier. Black Diamond. Go ahead.
Well, you're pretty good at a lot of things. That much is clear, and I know you have a lot to share with us. We need to take our first commercial break, but when we continue, we'll hear from Ted Robinson of Sacramento. You can hear that New York accent, though, still, can't you? We'll hear from Ted about how he came to know a young lieutenant named John F. Kennedy and how those two worlds collided in a very real way, how he's honored the late president's legacy in recent history. Maybe you saw him on TV when he was doing it, when he left a special present in Washington, D.C. We're going to get all those stories from Ted Robinson, author of the book Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're talking with a Navy veteran of World War II, Ted Robinson, 91 years old of Sacramento, still has enough energy to talk to us after finishing his tennis match earlier today. Yes, he still plays tennis at age 91. And there are a lot more incredible things than that about his story, which you can read about in his book, Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. You can link to that at our website, kmjnow.com. It's published by Merriam Press. You can find it on the Merriam Press website as well. And Ted, we left off. You told us your memory of December 7th, 1941, that your touch football game was interrupted by this radio announcement that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor.
Right.
You said they let you off the hook till the next month, January, when you entered midshipman school. Did you know that early on that that you would end up in PT boats, or how did that develop?
Well, at the end of I was a 90-day wonder. I had I was in that V7 program where if you were a college graduate with top grades and all the things that Annapolis teaches, like advanced math and all, in 90 days they try to make us a hero and a gentleman and an officer and a gentleman. My wife said they didn't do a very good job in the second part, but but anyway, I came out number two in my midshipman's class, and our company, which was the number one company, Company 5 in midshipman school. And so I was allowed to choose my own duty. They took most of the 90-day wonders and stuck them on a 3-inch gun in some merchant ship going across the Atlantic. But if you were the tops, you could choose your own duty. And so I chose PT boats because it really irritated the hell out of me that a little junky country at that time, like Japan, would have the nerve to attack us. And I wanted to go right away out there and get them. I mean now. And so I chose PTs, even though they told us it was suicide work. And I said, yeah, it's going to be suicide work. Who's on the other side? Not me.
Well, you talk about that. And the most famous movie, I think, about PT boats, or one of them anyway, with John Wayne, is called We Were Expendable, or They Were Expendable. I mean, that's not a very good label you want on the kind of ship that you're leading.
Well, John Wayne, incidentally, is a friend of mine. We had a college for 36 years after the war at Balboa Island, and I could see John Wayne's house from our cottage, and I've been on his yacht. I spent a whole half a day with him one time, and believe it or not, when I asked him for his autograph, he said, no, I want yours, and that's one of the most flattering things that ever happened to me.
maybe after trying to portray a PT boat skipper, he knew what you had been through.
Yeah, and I arranged to get him a plaque for his yacht. His yacht is actually a Navy minesweeper that's been converted into a huge yacht. And we had a PT boat reunion in Newport Beach, California, one time. And we also had it on his yacht. So that was, I know him. Next question.
Well, so you made that choice to go on PT boats, which was certainly not the safest choice. It was a daring choice. You're not going to have a lot of protection. You're going to be in the thick of some serious fights.
You got to be a little nuts, actually. Well, actually, they sent us immediately after Pearl Harbor. Immediately after we were formed up at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, they sent us down to Panama, assuming the Japanese would try to destroy the locks after they destroyed our Pacific Fleet.
Right.
And we spent the first couple of months down there waiting for the Jap fleet to arrive. And we had one squadron of PT boats and one squadron of P-40 airplanes, and they said, "You guys stop them." And we waited for them, but they never showed up, so we had to go over to Guadalcanal and get them.
Well, absolutely, and there aren't many veterans of the Pacific War who can relate action this early on. I mean, this is 1943 that we're talking about, that you were over there right in the thick of it.
Yes, it was a year and a half before Omaha Beach.
Exactly. So,
we were out there with the 1st Marine Division, of which I have the greatest esteem. You might be aware that the big ship Navy left the 1st Marines on Guadalcanal and had to abandon them for 3 months because the Japanese Navy was so strong, and they had 22 airfields within 100 miles. So the big ship Navy on our side couldn't get up there, and when they did, they almost always got sunk by those wonderful long-range torpedoes the Japanese had. The Japanese outnumbered them, and we had terrible losses of the major fleet up there. But those 1st Marine guys hung in there, and they knew we were the only things out there for months trying to stop them at sea. We were trying to stop the Japanese supply line at night. We were no help in the day because the Japanese had, as I mentioned earlier, 22 airfields within 100 miles. So we had to hide our boats in the swamps in the daytime. But we went out at night. But what little air we had in those early days, which was just Henderson Field, one airport we just captured, they tried to stop the Japanese in the day, but they were very ineffective at night. It's hard to see the Japanese ships and barges coming at night. So they tried to stop the supply line at daytime, and we did it at night. That was our job.
And I'm sure you had had lots of practice that prepared you perfectly for those kind of situations.
No, nothing's further from the truth, because the one thing about our training in Panama, while we were waiting for the fleet to come in Panama, all our training was at daytime. None of it at night. We did have a lot of training with the P-40 airplanes trying to attack us and learning how to go like hell and then pull to starboard or pull to port and stop, and so they would overfly us. And that kind of training did help us. But we had no night training at all. And what was so pitiful about that is, of course, the Solomon Islands are totally full of reefs around every island for miles, and you cannot see reefs underwater at night. You can see them in the daytime. And so we lost one hell of a lot of boats on reefs, often chasing the Japanese that we had just been attacking. In fact, a month of the day after I rescued Kennedy, I lost my boat, the 118, 70 miles behind enemy lines, on a reef so close to the Japanese we had just been attacking, we could hear them talking, and we were only right off Vella Lavella, where they had 22,000 Japanese troops, and we were 70 miles away from the nearest Americans. how I got out of that mess, you got to read the book.
Well, I hope I can pull a little more out of it, out of you about it. But that book is called Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. You can link to it on our website, kmjnow.com. Ted, you talk about President Kennedy, and I want to get to that. But before that, maybe let me ask you some dumb questions, just so everyone listening is familiar with a PT boat, how it operates, and we can actually put ourselves in your shoes. What were your duties aboard that boat? Why do you call it a boat and not a ship? I think that'll enlighten some of us. And how many men do you have aboard?
Well, those boats are only 80 feet long, 20 feet wide, made entirely of plywood, 7-ply mahogany plywood. No armor plate, no defense whatsoever. They're suicide boats. But we carried 4 torpedoes that supposedly could sink the Japanese fleet. We'll get into the how that could is kind of a myth later on. But our job, of course, was to go in and get them. And so we had the smallest crew we could operate with because we had a very good chance of losing the boat and all of us. And so we had 2 officers and 4 enlisted men. I mean, 10 enlisted men. Mm-hmm. And my boat was destroyed within 8 weeks, not totally destroyed, but bombed within 8 weeks after arriving at Guadalcanal. Everybody on my boat, I started as the executive officer. 60% of our officers in PT Squadron 6 were Naval Academy graduates. They made them the skippers, and then us 90-day wonders were the executive officers. So my skipper had his head blown off right in front of me, and everybody killed the wounded but 3 of us within 8 weeks. But the boat wasn't totally destroyed. I got hit in the head with shrapnel, but I had my helmet on, and I'm only 5'6". Had I been an inch taller, I would have been dead. I didn't even get the Purple Heart because they didn't break skin. So then I became skipper. That's how I got promoted to skipper. And then they put another skipper in charge of me, and he went Section 8, which means he decided he wanted to get into another line of work, preferably back in the States. Actually went crazy within 2 missions. So I became skipper for the second time. And then they eventually, I got another Naval Academy guy as my skipper, Percy, and he was a great guy, and he lasted the whole war with me, and there's only a handful of us lasted that whole year, just 5 of us out of 50, to tell you the truth. It was terrible.
Well, that certainly puts it in perspective for us, and, you know, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and you talk about other people going crazy. If I saw my skipper's head blown off and I got hit in the head myself, I might go crazy too. How did you avoid that? What kept you focused? What kept you motivated? What kept your head screwed on straight?
I'll tell you exactly what. I was the youngest youngest officer in my squadron. I was small, I was little, I was young, and I was determined not to show fear in front of my enlisted men. I was so young, the other officers called me Little Robbie because we had 3 Robinsons out there that were officers. And so I was more afraid of showing fear to my enlisted men than they were of dying. I was determined never to quit, so I never turned down a mission. And, in fact, by the reason they selected me to pick up Jack is I had already been out there 3 months before Jack had arrived. I was out there a half a year before Hank Branningham, who was the head of that attack on August 1st, 1943. And he looked at me as a veteran and at one tough little kid. And that's what kept me going. And the other thing is stupid. But I kept thinking to myself, I am the youngest guy here, the little baby-faced kid, and it's not fair for me to die. The others are older than me. They should go first. It's not my turn yet. And I convinced myself of that. And time after time, for instance, I had a quartermaster who was shot right through his mouth when he was talking that stood right next to me. When you read my book, You will see time after time, I just miss being killed. And I said, it's only fair. God should make it, let me live the longest.
Well, apparently he agreed with you.
Yeah. And I was also, I've never had a dream like you hear about these guys having. And my wife will tell you that I was so happy when I came home that I was still alive. And she thought I was kind of a nut. I was always so cheerful and happy. My whole thing was, how lucky can I get? And she began to think I was a little bit of a jerk, which she changed her mind, thank God, because my wife is from Newport, Rhode Island. I am not poverty-stricken anymore.
Well, we might hear more about that, too. Right now, we need to catch another break, but we'll be right back with Ted Robinson telling us about that date that he teased you with, August 1st and 2nd, 1943, how he came to rescue a future president of the United States. Maybe you've heard about PT-109. Ted was on PT-118, and he had the privilege of rescuing that crew of PT-109 and a man that you know as President John F. Kennedy. We'll get that story when Hometown Heroes continues next here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating discussion today with 91-year-old World War II veteran Ted Robinson. He lives in Sacramento, California now. He's originally from Flushing, New York. Spent his college days at Duke, and he's good friends with Mike Krzyzewski. I don't know if we'll talk basketball. We do have basketball coming up later tonight, Fresno State against UC Santa Barbara. But let's talk about World War II some more and how Ted Robinson, our guest today, came to rescue a future president of the United States. Walk us through that night, Ted. You talked about doing most of your PT boat battles at night because
that was the only time you could operate.
What
happened. It was August 1st, 1943.
Uh-huh.
We got all our intelligence from the bravest men in the world who, in my opinion, the bravest men in the world, who were the Coast Watchers. They were the Australians and New Zealanders and Brits that had been the managers of the copra plantations, because those islands, the Solomon Islands, were owned by the British, and they were full of palm trees where the palm olive soap came from. Mm-hmm. And they asked those guys to go back in to the jungles in those islands and live with the natives who they had once familiar with, because they had once managed those plantations, and send out intelligence from behind enemy lines as to what the Japanese were doing. So on August 1st, 1943, our coast watcher that was hidden behind the lines said the Japanese were going to have a major reinforcement of Munda airstrip on New Georgia Island. Now, that was the second airstrip our army were trying to take. So we would have two airfields, and the Japanese would only have 20. And so that was called the Munda Campaign, and we knew they were coming down. We knew they had to come through Blackett Strait to get to Munda airstrip, and they were sending down five destroyers with 900 enemy troops aboard, and we should do everything we could do to stop them. They were coming, of course, at night. And so we got every PT that would run, which was 15 PT boats, and we went north 30 miles, and we had to go through this narrow passage called Ferguson Passage. Well, three of our boats never made it through there, so 12 of them actually got into Blackett Strait. And they never made it in there because the Japanese float planes, amphibious planes, knew that we had to go through this narrow one-mile passage. So they constantly dropped parachute flares, one after the other, to find us, and then each carried three 100-pound bombs, and they tried to stop us. Well, they frequently did sink one of us. But that night, 12 of us of the 15 did get in there, and we got in there. And it's just like a football game. We would put four PT boats. We'd go into Blackett Strait, where we knew the Japanese were coming, to get to Munda. And we would put our boats just barely one could see the other at night. They're about 5 miles wide, Blackett Strait, 5 to 8 miles wide. And we would lie in wait. Well, I wasn't in my own boat. My own boat was damaged again. We were constantly full of holes. often with American 50 caliber holes, because we frequently fired into each other in all the confusion. But anyway, my boat was under repair, and so I went in on the 159 boat, where the squadron commander, who was Hank Brenningham, who had been John Buckley's exec at the Philippines and got MacArthur out of the Philippines. A lot of us Navy guys thought we should have left him there, but anyway.
I think Brenningham, a lot of them guys left behind,
was in charge of the entire attack. So he said, "Robbie, I want you to go in with me. You just arrived. Your boat isn't up there. But I want you to go in with me and be radar officer of the entire attack." Now, the important thing of that is we only had on radar on three of those 12 boats, and I was the official radar officer. Well, when it's totally black at night, that meant only three men, the three guys on radar, could really see what happened. In the black, you don't see things. It's just black out there if you've ever been out on the water at night. And so I was standing next to Brenningham, and I picked up the tips coming in on my radar screen. Only four, one of the Japanese destroyers, had broken down. And so we got ready to go into our attack. And next to us was a 157 boat. Liebenau was skipper of that. And we went in, slowly sneaked in, and we made our attack. Anybody out there know how PT boats make attacks? It's horrifying, absolutely horrifying. What you do is you have to sneak in. You don't go in with the American flag flying. First place, you never wear your uniforms. You're always behind enemy lines. The Japanese, of course, would bayonet us to death and make us decapitate each other. Oh, they were awful cruel. If they got us, they'd cut a piece of our nose off and then a piece. Oh, they're terrible. So we would sneak in with our mufflers closed because we had three 1,500 horsepower engines. That's almost 6,000 horsepower. So and we were behind enemy lines with 100,000 Japanese surrounding us on all these islands. And they had their shore batteries ready, their mortars ready, and everything else ready to get us. So we had to close our mufflers. That is key to why Jack lost his boat. You'll find out in a minute. Anyway, we would sneak in with our mufflers closed until they discovered us. Now, luckily, the Japanese did not have radar, nor, incidentally, did Jack Kennedy, nor any of the other nine boats or so. But we sneaked in, but the Japanese would have a little guy way up 100 feet high in the crow's nest, and they saw all of us before we saw them, except for Ross radar boats. And we went in very carefully until they spotted us. Now, when they spotted us, it's unbelievable. They turn on all these searchlights, and there's nothing makes you feel more bare than those searchlights. It reminded me when I was at Duke in my little 34 convertible with my little southern girlfriend from Norton, Virginia, and the campus cop would put the flashlight in the window, and when we were parked in Lover's Lane. Boy, those searchlights are come on. Now, all those searchlights are now, of course, in front of car dealers selling Hondas and Toyotas that we're all driving, which don't get me started on that. But anyway, when those searchlights came on, it was really beautiful because they had these beautiful searchlights, and suddenly there were all these fountains all around you. What they were shells. Five-inch shells, we would have four destroyers with five five-inch major guns. In other words, 20 five-inch guns, all their anti-aircraft guns, and 900 soldiers lying shoulder to shoulder, all firing at us. And the explosions would push our boat sideways and throw water over us, but they kept missing. Now, they didn't always keep missing. We lost scads of boats, but we didn't lose the 159 that night. And so the minute you're discovered, you open your mufflers, which takes about 10 minutes, and that's key to this whole Jack Kennedy thing, and then you're committed. So you push your throttles forward and you go in. Of course, the planes are immediately on top of you, but you're committed now. And we went into 1,400 yards. Now, you're a football announcer. 1,400 yards sounds like a long ways. That's 14 football fields. But broadside to all that firepower, it was horrifying. And we closed to 1,400 yards, and we fired our torpedoes. Now, after you, the only reason any PT boat guy is alive today that made a destroyer attack is after we fired our torpedoes, we would make a very tight turn to make our escape, to hopefully make our turn where you really slow down and you're really going to die. They had to take a defensive maneuver. And that maneuver was to turn into us to expose only their narrow bow instead of their whole broadside to our torpedoes.
Right.
When they made that turn going at top speed, they went 39 knots, almost 40, 50 miles an hour. That would, the decks would lean over and you would see their gunfire on one side going in the water and the other side going up in the air. And that's what saved us. Because they turned into us to, so they would only expose that narrow bow. And secondly, to ram us. Jack wasn't the only PT boat rammed. He was the only PT boat that had a president in it that was rammed. Nobody gives a damn about a park commissioner like me, which I am. I'm the park commissioner in Sacramento County Parks. But anyway, we made our turn, and we got out. And once you make your turn, we had a smokescreen generator on the stern that put up white smoke. White smoke, if you remember 4th of July, is very effective against floodlights.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go at high speed because we would have lost 6 tons in weight. Those torpedoes weighed 1.5 tons each. And we would zigzag behind the smokescreen at high speed trying to get out alive. Well, we got out alive, and so did the 157 next to us. And we went back across Blackett Strait out of range from the destroyers, and we pulled up next to the 157 boat. And because Branningham, that was in charge of the entire attack, was on my boat, he shouted off to Liebenauer's boat. He said, did you fire all four fish, all four torpedoes? And they said, no, we only fired two. Branningham said, get your butt in there and fire the other two. I think I would have jumped over the side before I did that. But Liebenauer did. He went in there
and
tried to find him. Now, that's what happened to us. Now, what happened next? While we were talking to the 157, we saw this terrible explosion just south of us about where Jack Kennedy and PT-109 and the 162 boat. There were two of them back in there. We knew that from the radar, and we knew that's where they had gone. They were desperately trying to get into position to attack the destroyers. When suddenly, coming from the south, the destroyers had unloaded their troops at Munda, and they were coming back from an unexpected direction in total darkness at top speed, trying to get back out of there alive. And Jack Kennedy was going at very slow speed. You couldn't go over 6 knots with your mufflers closed, so you just had to drift, kind of. And his mufflers were closed by order of all of us. Otherwise, the Japanese planes, the Japanese shore battery could hear us. We had three 1,500 horsepower engines. You could hear those. That's 6,000 horsepower. You could hear it for 25 miles if your mufflers weren't closed. Suddenly, the starboard lookout, who was in the starboard gun turret, screamed a warning, and he saw two ships coming right at him. Now, the next thing that Mommy Dearest books, who criticized Jack, saying he was asleep, is what they say. Imagine being asleep during that gunfire. Holy crap. Anyway, all those cannons going off and searchlights. Well, anyway, when you're back in the States, you can write a book with a bunch of lies. But by anything, that's what these guys do that hate Kennedy. But anyway, so Jack was cruising back for it. Now, the next thing he had to do, he had to make sure those two ships coming right at him were not American PT boats.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he'd be firing into his own men. And we did that a lot. And we wanted to avoid that. We got orders every night. Make sure they're the enemy. Or were they maybe American destroyers that humped him? So we had to pause and watch for that. And once he sure it was really Japanese ships. He looked up in horror. They were coming right for him, and he jammed his throttles forward. He did just what you would have done, all your audience in Fresno would have done, all the Mommy Dearest books writers would have done. It was his only chance. He knew it took 10 to 15 minutes to open his mufflers.
Yeah, no choice.
Because he had to push a button up on the control cabinet up in the cockpit.
Well, Ted, I apologize. I have to cut you off there because we're up against a commercial, but we'll come right back, get the rest of that story, how President Kennedy and his boat got out of there, how you were able to rescue him later. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We had to stop Ted Robinson there, right in the thick of it with President John F. Kennedy. He wasn't president yet. He was on a PT boat in the Pacific. And you talked about him having no choice, Ted, but to do what he did. And unfortunately, he got hit square on by a Japanese ship. And this was the huge explosion that you saw.
Yes. And anyway, what happened? The bow floated. Now, all the men were thrown into the water and to the flaming gasoline. But fortunately, Jack told me the only reason they survived is that destroyer was going so fast, the bow wake of the destroyer carried the flaming gasoline away from the wooden hull of the PT boat. That meant he could jump over the side, which he did, and drag back his men. Doing so, he got terribly burned by gasoline burns. We had 3,000 gallons of gasoline on those boats. And he dragged them back to the bow. And then the next day, they were all cleaning the bow. Of course, the machinist mate in the engine room had drowned, and some others had died. But 11 were still alive, and they were hanging onto the hull. And the hull started to drift towards Kualam and Gara, where the Japanese had 40,000 enemy troops. So that night, Jack took the most severely wounded man and towed him with his teeth all the way to a little island called Palm Island, and the rest made rafts out of wreckage and finally got over to Plum Island. And for a whole week, Jack Kennedy went out day after day trying to flag us down, coming through that Ferguson Passage, because the island he purposely swam to, Plum Island, was right next to Ferguson Passage, and there were no Japanese on that island. So he night after night, swam out there trying to attract us. Well, we were looking up. We were looking up at the float planes that were bombing us. We didn't see a little man down in the waves. Well, we finally found out. We got two Melanesian natives paddled 30 miles and handed me a coconut. That's the most famous coconut in the world. And on it, Jack had scratched, 11 still alive, send help, JFK. They handed it to me. I handed it to Branningham, my commanding officer. And Branningham said, Robbie, would you like to go in on the rescue mission? And thank God I said yes. I said yes because I like Jack. You don't turn down your commanding officer, and I wanted to really help him. So we went 30 miles behind enemy lines. We finally found him back there in Plum Island. We brought him and what was left of his crew home. Then they sent him back down the line to recuperate. And a month to the day later, I lost my boat 70 miles behind enemy lines. They put me in the same tent with Jack. I got to be great friends with him. We lived alone for 2.5 months together. I got to know what he was like, what he talked about, and so on, and became his friend for the rest of his life. And I married a lovely girl whose family did a lot of the fine artworks in Jackie's home, Jackie Kennedy's home. So we both had wives that were from Newport whose families knew each other. I kept in touch through my father-in-law, who would frequently be at Jackie's home when Jack was there, and we would send messages back and forth through my father-in-law.
You spent that time with him in that tent, and obviously you knew what kind of family he was from and the influence his father had had, but did you have any inkling that this guy next to you without a shirt on is still recovering from all these wounds and using a cane, which you have since donated to the Smithsonian? Did you have any inkling that this was a future president of the United States?
I knew he was smarter than I was. He was very smart. And the thing that really convinced me is we had never had a candy bar for half a year, and the Destroyers had candy. I took my candy, and I threw the wrapper in the jungles after I... Jack didn't do that. We had nothing to read. We were reduced to nothing. We were, you know, we didn't get any mail or anything. And so he would read all the ingredients of the candy wrapper because that's what he was reduced to. And he'd say, Robbie, how come the Hershey bars have 20% corn syrup and Baby Ruth? I knew then this guy was sharp. The smart people in the world are curious about everything. The other thing that I was privileged to be with him, he said, you know, he always made friends with the chief of the village. We lived in native villages the whole time around there. And he said, you know, I've been talking to the chief, and these people have a life expectancy of 35 because they have no medical help whatsoever. And he said to me, alone in the tent, someday a wealthy country like America should help people like this. I didn't realize it at that time, but that was the start of the Peace Corps, and I was privileged to be alone in the tent when he came up with that thought. I was just thinking, oh, they're just natives, so what? Not Jack. He wanted to know how he could help them. He was a great guy. He had a great sense of humor. When we picked him up, he was burned, he was disabled, he couldn't walk, his feet were in shreds. And you know what he said? In the darkness, he said, where in the hell have you guys been? I've been at this bus stop for a whole week now. Can you imagine that? The sense of humor he had when he had been starving for a week. He was burned. He was crippled. His feet were gone. He was a great guy.
That's probably
and
a lot of what kept him going.
Originally was a Republican. Now, that comes from a Republican. Sorry about that, you Republicans. He was a great guy.
Well, Ted, I think the same can be said of you. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time, and I hope people will get your book so they can read the rest of your incredible story. That book is Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President. We have it linked at our website, kmjnow.com. You can find it on Amazon, on Merriam Press. Ted, in closing, is there any one thing that your experience in the Navy in World War II taught you that you think has been really important in the rest of your life?
Yeah, and that is you got to persevere no matter how bad things get. You got to stick to them, and I love my country. I love it to this day. And don't ever let any of your listeners reduce our military so we're in the situation we were in the start of World War II, because our torpedoes were no damn good. We were using World War I torpedoes, 30 years old, giving our lives to go in to try to sink the enemy. Don't ever let us get in that situation again. Well, kids, look out for your country.
Well, I hear you. Ted, thank you so much for serving our country, for sharing a little bit of your story today, and I hope everybody listening will read the rest of it in your book. Thanks a lot, Ted.
My regards to everybody in Fresno. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. That's Ted Robinson of Sacramento, California. He's been our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.